This is Emily with your Politics in Action report at your local radio station, CJMQ 88.9 FM, bringing you your local, provincial, and federal political news. Highway 410, running through Sherbrooke Center to South End, is extending further, a project scheduled by 2020. Construction is reported to be beginning within the coming months. The construction will continue on between Highways 108 and 143. An official announcement was made last Friday in Sherbrooke. Attendance included Quebec Transport Minister André Fortin, Quebec Member of Assembly for Sherbrooke Luc Fortin, Federal Minister Marie-Claude Bibeau, as well as other public officials. The project will cost an estimated $75 million. The Government of Canada is subsidizing $37.2 million, while the Quebec government is responsible for the remaining costs. The incentive to extend the highway comes from the amount of users, including heavy delivery trucks, that will require greater accessibility in the Lennoxville borough. This is considered phase two of a two-phase project. This comes after 3 years ago when the highway was extended, allowing access to Rue Belvedere on top of College Street to Highway 143 in downtown Lennoxville via Queen Street, which was phase one. So as we progress forward into the future, what comes with this is easier accessibility to various destinations. And this is true for ground transportation. Greater transportation means we are able to connect to everyone and much swifter. Put simply, people are able to commute to work much faster, goods are able to reach their destinations swifter and on time. Time is of an essence, and it is becoming increasingly important to increase accessibility. And what a lot of people don't realize is that federal investments into transportation are making citizens' lives better. With the interconnection of communities, we can only hope for greater prosperity. Sherbrooke is a thriving city that continues to grow. Lennoxville, in particular, is enlarging as a borough, and this highway extension is proof of that. In the next 7 months, Quebecers will find themselves in the midst of a provincial election campaign. We are already seeing promises being laid out by prospective premier candidates. If re-elected, Premier Philippe Couillard promises to invest millions into public transportation for Montreal and Quebec City. This investment will go into constructing tramways and tram bus systems, which would be something new and innovative for Quebec's two largest cities. This policy put forward by Couillard is strategic because this initiative would appeal to some majority of the Quebec population that reside in these two major cities. As such, transportation is considered one of the main subjects to be brought up in the next provincial election. This is increasingly so for Quebec City and is an issue pitting the Quebec Liberals and the CAQ at odds with one another. Couillard's reasoning is that in order for this project to happen, requires the re-election of the Liberals, as CAQ's leader François Legault, according to Couillard, will see this project torn up and thrown out the window. As of yesterday, Gabriel Nadeau-Dubois officially announced his candidacy as leader of the Quebec Solidaire for the next election. Dubois will be running within the electoral district of Gouin. The party has its best chances of gaining seats in Montreal, which is where its voter base is concentrated. It's important to establish the face of the party, for voters to relate to one leader. Opposed to the dual leadership the Quebec Solidaire previously operated under, which was both odd and a bit confusing to voters. What we often associate with political campaigns are business proposals. So essentially, what this upcoming provincial election comes down to is who will have the best sales pitch. Taking a look at the latest polls from CBC's poll tracker, it demonstrates the CAQ is in the lead at 34% of the vote, followed by the Quebec Liberals trailing close behind at 30%, the PQ securing third at 23%, and the Quebec Solidaire at 8%. So far, it looks like it will be a close election. My prediction, based on these polls, is that the next government, whether that is the CAQ or the Liberals, will operate under a minority government, because they are within close proximity of one another. The polls do indicate a possibility for the CAQ to acquire a majority government, based on the seat projection, but I believe it will be a close election. According to the CBC, and if these polls are accurate in the fall election, the PQ will be performing the worst it has ever done in provincial elections since its creation in 1968. Some people make a direct link with the PQ's federal counterpart, the Bloc Québécois, and see this correlation of the French-based parties failing at both the provincial and federal levels. It is true that sovereignty is no longer a defining topic. However, the PQ is still quite popular in the province of Quebec, despite being low in the polls. As for the Quebec Solidaire, it does have a short time to gain some momentum, and if it does, which I doubt it will at this point in time, it may acquire a share of the Liberals' vote base in Montreal. But because it is at least 15 percentage points behind the PQ, it is safe to say that it will acquire the fourth spot in the next election. Based on their media presence, I believe the election will come down to either a Liberal or the CAQ's victory. I will provide an update on the latest polls at a later date. As the Bloc Québécois continues to sink in the depths of federal politics, leader Maxime Ouellet has decided to hold a referendum regarding a vote of confidence on her leadership. This is surprising news, given how Ouellet stood firmly in her position and was resistant to even think her leadership skills should be put into question. This announcement was prompted today in Ottawa. Details will be provided later once the party holds a meeting in Quebec on April 29th. So what does a vote of confidence ultimately mean? Essentially, a vote of confidence means discerning whether the leader has the confidence, also known as support, in their leadership and policy initiatives. The next question to pose is what would occur if a leader loses the vote of confidence? In common sense, the loss of support of a leader means that the people under the leadership desire for the leader to step down. Therefore, if Maxime Ouellet loses the vote of confidence, she will have to step down as leader. And why wouldn't she? If she truly has the best interests of the Bloc Québécois, then she will step down and allow someone else to lead into the next federal election. Conversely, if Ouellet has the confidence of the remaining members of the party, then she will continue to lead, but it would be risky. And it would be risky for Ouellet to stay on as party leader, considering current projection of the polls indicates that the Bloc would obtain 0 seats if the federal election was to be held today. From what it looks like, we can predict that Ouellet will not be leading the Bloc in the next federal election. Based on recent events that have taken place, 7 of the Bloc members leaving the party, we know already that Ouellet does not have confidence as a leader. The question we must ask now is, who will lead the Bloc Québécois in the next federal election? The federal government is planning to enact a gun bill this week that specifies for greater screening for prospective gun owners. In essence, this bill will decree managing gun ownership out of the hands of individuals with mental illness and those with a violent background. This will also involve gun shop owners to verify purchasers' license to own a gun before a sale. In other words, making gun shop owners handle greater responsibility at point of sale. This comes after the Florida high school shooting and a movement ensued in the United States. But this also comes from events that hit home. Last November, both victims and families of gun violence voiced their desires for stricter gun laws on Parliament Hill to Public Safety Minister Ralph Goodale. What many people don't realize is that these families and survivors had the unfortunate occurrence of experiencing some form of gun violence. The fact of the matter is, in concerning these individuals, is that you wouldn't want something to be done if it happened to you or a loved one in your family. As a preventative measure, we don't want any more families to be impacted by gun violence. I believe this is the message driving gun restriction lobbyists. While this gun reform bill is labeled as controversial, I don't believe it is as controversial as it would be if our neighbors to the south was to enact stricter gun regulations. Based on what I was told by an individual with a certified gun permit in Canada, there are greater restrictions already in gun ownership. For instance, for storing one's arms, you must have your bullets and guns stored in separate locations. So it is less accessible, and this means owning a gun in Canada would be for recreational purposes, so such as hunting, rather than for self-defense. Self-defense is the reason that individuals in our neighbor country, the US, have reason for owning a gun. However, consider the fact that law enforcers who exist on the purpose of protecting citizens do have arms. So what more assurance do we need that we are protected? This would be an argument put forward to people of the United States, who have time and again proven not only that they, as citizens, are evidently not responsible enough to handle guns, but having citizens and law enforcers armed with guns is a recipe for disaster. From my basic understanding, in Canada, you must provide documented reason for doing anything with your gun. People might ask, why is Canada involved in stricter gun control? Because it is demonstrating national responsibility. We are learning from our neighbors to the south that greater screening is necessary to prevent catastrophes from occurring in the first place. In other words, we are being responsible as a nation for something that the US should have done long ago. Jagmeet Singh is under fire after a video has surfaced indicating that Singh had attended a conference promoting Sikh independence. Singh had responded to the outbreak of this video by stating he was present at the conference to express his opposition to the use of violence. Leader Jagmeet Singh may have tarnished his chances in the next federal election. Even while his intentions were not to support the Sikh separatists and their use of violence, his presence at the event makes voters question whether his motivations are religiously motivated. And I'm a bit disappointed because I wanted to see how Singh would have done in the next election. But now, he has for sure lost the support of some of his voters. Regardless of his intention, it was a big mistake to attend the event as it sends the wrong idea to voters. Singh has also made an appeal for Canada to recognize the slaying of Sikhs in India in 1984 as a genocide. And this is off-putting to Canadians for the reason that Canadians believe this has nothing to do with Canada and want to keep their interests at home. The slaying of the Sikhs occurred following the assassination of Indian Prime Minister Indira Gandhi, and an aerial bombing followed as a response to this assassination. The exact number of deaths is unclear. The Indian nation stated the death toll was around 3,000, while Sikh leaders claim the number is higher at 10,000. Singh has stated that declaring the event as a genocide would aid with bringing peaceful relations between the Hindus and the Sikhs. I'm not 100% sure this will help with peaceful relations given that conflicts within states are best resolved by the state itself. The opinion of outside states can perhaps prompt fury and greater conflicts. In other words, it is like picking sides. This occurs with international peacekeeping operations into conflicts as conducted by international organizations such as the United Nations. Some scholars have argued that it adds fuel to the fire rather than resolving conflict. That Western hands or influence into the affairs of another nation comes off as Western control, as well as comes off as Western attempts to establish what they believe is the ideal political system, which is democracy. While yes, it is relevant to denounce horrible events that occur internationally, individuals have perceived Singh's inquiries into this devastation as moving away from the Canadian interests. This doesn't sit well with many Canadians, particularly Quebecers. Quebecers in particular have moved away from religious involvement with the state since the Quiet Revolution, so any chance for Singh to acquire Quebec voters has been hindered. On a positive note, Singh's actions may demonstrate sympathy for multiculturalism, and this will appeal to a wide variety of cultures and religions in Canada. As a candidate for Prime Minister, it is also relevant to set oneself apart from other candidates. However, it could come at a cost if a candidate is emphasizing too much into a given issue. But Singh's actions do exemplify his desires to maintain harmonious diplomatic relations, which is a key responsibility of the Prime Minister of Canada. Nonetheless, Singh's actions will put him behind in the polls and has significantly harmed his campaign. While my reports have specifically been focused on Canadian news, I'd like to explore some news that developed overseas this past weekend. Russia's president will serve another 6-year term as president after being re-elected in Sunday's election. Putin has been Russia's president in 1999 to 2008 and was re-elected in 2012. The general consensus is that Putin won by 76% of the Russian vote, which is an evident majority. The runner-up was Pavel Grudinin, who won 12% of the vote. Clearly, a great margin separates the two candidates. However, that number seems projected and possibly skewed. With a high voter turnout, some have attributed this high turnout as being the result of citizens being forced to vote. A Russian doctor had reported that 2 o'clock was the deadline that they had to report to their superiors that they had voted. As well, the great influx of voters was seen between noon and 2 p.m. Citizens were taking photos of pamphlets distributed by poll workers as proof of voting. So unlike Canada, where we have the right but are not obliged to vote, Russian citizens feel pressured to vote for one dominant leader. As in democratic countries, not all citizens exercise the right to vote and are not penalized for not doing so. A basic component of democracy is free and fair elections, which means all political competitors have a fair chance of winning the election, and winning the election will be based on policy positions and their charisma. There was anticipation of Putin's re-election, given that he was up against relatively minor candidates and his main competitor, Alexei Navalny, was banned from partaking in the election. This implies this election was tainted and fixed from the start. In context of these events, requires a closer look at Russia's history. Russia had held its first election in 1991, and this was a time when Russia transitioned from its dictatorial rule of the Communist Party through much of the 20th century to a democratic, quote-unquote, regime. To clarify, the Russian political system is a federal system which is composed of a quote-unquote elected president with a bicameral legislature, meaning two chambers of government, and an appointed prime minister by the choice of the president. So in other words, this political system grants much of the power with the president. Russia is supposed to be a representative democracy, however, this has been tainted with corruption. Evidence of this comes from reports that ballots were secretly added to the ballot boxes, cameras capturing ballot boxes were edited, and discrepancies in ballots. In a regular representative democracy, if any of the events were to occur during an election, many actions would be followed to ensure no corruption or deception. For instance, investigations would be put into place to verify whether these claims were true, and to discern any deception that might have taken place. As well, if ballots had been alleged to have been added, a recount would take place. While this seems like an overwhelming amount of years in office, this is not something new for the Russian president. The manner by which politics is structured differs from state to state. It is the essence of comparative politics. If reports of Russian interference into the American election are out in the open, who is to say that Putin wouldn't have pulled the strings to win his own presidency? The Putin regime had been labeled as a managed democracy, as stated by one of my former professors of comparative politics, which means Russia is classified as a democracy, but there is some evidence of tampering and corruption, which has tainted the natural process of democracy. That is it for this session of Politics in Action. Until then, take care. I'm Emily at CJMQ 88.9 FM.